Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am so delighted to welcome back into our studios a good friend of the Morning Show, Jack Rose, who is co-president of the Kenosha County chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. May is Mental Illness Awareness Month, and tomorrow evening is a special vigil for mental health awareness. And we're going to be talking about what that event is all about. It is called Speak Up, Change Minds, and it's going to be happening at Civic Center Park, a reception at 5, and then the vigil itself at 6 p.m., and we'll kind of run through the whole gamut of what is expected to occur at this special vigil. And we'll talk more comprehensively, of course, about the importance of talking about and understanding the nature of mental illness and what those who are contending with it most need from the rest of us. Jack Rose, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much, Greg. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. I know that a lot of people probably know a little bit about your own story, about your own personal connection to this cause, to this concern. But briefly, for the sake of anybody listening who isn't aware of your own background, just say a quick word about why you care so deeply about the issue of mental illness.
Oh, I certainly will. My wife and I have been exposed, really, to mental illness at an early start. Our daughter, who is now 44, was hospitalized for 30 days in a mental hospital in Virginia when we were still in the Navy. And we didn't know too much about it at that time. Our daughter was having some issues with depression and drinking. And so that exposed us. At that particular time, and this was in around 1986, the protocol, if you may, was, well, 30 days in the hospital, and you're out. And that's basically what insurance covered, and you march on. So I think we were very fortunate that our daughter came back. She completed high school and went on and graduated college in 3 years at Virginia Commonwealth University, and went on to be a very successful goldsmith. And so that was a start. We didn't know too much about it. And then our son, who graduated from the University of Wisconsin, was out in San Francisco and right in 1999, and he was attending our daughter's wedding, and we thought, well, he's a graphic designer. Our daughter was marrying a person that was getting into the Silicon Valley, the big boom out there, and we thought, wow, what a fit. Well, our son had a breakdown right after that, 24 years old. And that started his journey with mental illness. And so he initially was really misdiagnosed, highly over-medicated. But he's 24 years old, so he became very aware that he's an adult. And so parents at that time can only do so much. And I think we see that every day now here in our efforts in the community, where adults want to help, but their child is now an adult, so you move on. So that was the background that we started with. And right now we are really blessed. Our daughter is 44. She is the director of Integral Yoga at the Yogaville Ashram in Buckingham, Virginia. And our son is happily married, And Sue and I just went out 2 weeks ago for our granddaughter's first birthday.
Mm.
So our son lives with depression, and he has been extremely successful. He takes a daily dose of Zoloft, and very active, very successful, and we march on.
Mm.
So that brought us into our passion for trying to improve the quality of life for people with mental illness.
Mm. And it's good that these two particular stories have resolved themselves as happily as they have, because, of course, there's many, many more stories that that don't necessarily resolve themselves as successfully as your two children. It's something very much to be grateful for.
I would like to add, though, it's been a very long journey.
Right.
If you go back to 86 with our daughter, and she had some problems again in 2006, 2007, our son initially diagnosed with in 1999, and, you know, here it is, 2016. And so it's still a journey, and so we continue with. But yes, we are very grateful for where we are right now, where our children are right now, and we count our blessings every day.
So, outline for our listeners the three pillars of NAMI, the three sort of core purposes to the organization.
The core. It's education, support, and advocacy. I think it's key that the education piece, that we need to promote mental health awareness in our community, and we are really striving to do that. And you look at some of the programs that we have, I think that have been quite successful. The family-to-family program, which is a 12-week course for family members and loved ones of those affected with mental illness. We just finished a class here last month. We've got two classes going on now. We've got one at the job center where we completed 20 people. We've got another one out at the county center building on Highway 50 and 45. We completed 15 out there. And so everybody says we have to move west. We're moving west of Kenosha. So the family-to-family program. We also have three qualified facilitators that teach family-to-family in Spanish.
Hmm.
And so we continually reach out to the Hispanic community, and we're making a little bit of headway. We've had two classes like three years ago, over, you know, a couple of years in a row. Small numbers, but we had them. And so this year we may be able to have another class in the fall.
Hmm.
And so we strive to do that. Our crisis intervention team training, that's for law enforcement. And we've been very very successful, I think. To date, we've got 165 completers to date. We started this program in Kenosha in 2010. It's a huge collaborative effort between Gateway Technical College, where we hold the course, and we have a contract. We, NAMI Kenosha, has a contract with Gateway to provide administrative support, since we're an all-volunteer. We don't have staff. We have volunteers, great
right.
volunteers.
Right.
And so that has worked very well.
And that's thousands of people we're talking about who have received that training, right?
Well, if you go with CIT, we've got 165 completers, law enforcement. Then you have the two-day program, which is for the general public. I mean, it can be for ER staff. It can be for school advisors. It can be for maintenance people in a group home. It can be for your jail staff. And with that, we have 538 have gone through that class. And so we have our CIT coming up here in September. I think it's CIT number 7 coming up September 12th through the 16th. And then we have our next crisis intervention partner training coming up November 16th and 17th. We also have our In Our Own Voice program. And this is a program where we have people that are living with a mental illness. They go out and tell their story. They talk about the dark days. They talk about their acceptance. They talk about their treatment program. They talk about their coping strategies. And they talk about their hopes and their dreams. This has been very, very successful. And we have large numbers in this, and we continue to build on our In Our Own Voice program. And right now we're scheduled July 16th and 17th. We're in conjunction with NAMI Wisconsin. We're going to be holding a training here in Kenosha for another In Our Own Voice class. I think this is important. The another one that has been very successful, Walkabout Rewards. People with mental illness have a life expectancy of 25 years shorter than people without. So we've started a Walkabout Rewards where people start walking. They get 30 sessions of walking. We have an agreement with Chuck Gustafson out at Rogan's Shoes on the interstate. These folks go out and get fitted for a pair of shoes, and then NAMI Kenosha goes ahead and buys those shoes. And really the key thing as far as a wellness program that we have here, and if you talk about treatment, it's a lot more than just medication. It's medication, it's therapy, extremely important, and it's just overall wellness. And so we started a program at the Y, and this is, again, a collaborative effort between NAMI and the YMCA in town. And it started, I don't know, I think about 3 years ago. And we had a group of community support folks that were in a support session, and they wanted to start walking. So they started the walking program, and then they said, "Well, let's do something where we can take folks out to the Y." And so we've tried some individual programs in the past, haven't been quite successful, but now it started out where a caseworker would take out. Oh, five people from community support. They'd go out to the Y, they stay together as a group, they would go walk the track, play hoops, go for a swim, whatever, as a group. Well, we have progressed now to a point, and NAMI Kenosha has purchased two group packages, and right now we have 220 people in that program. And they go out individually. That's right on a bus route. And so it's truly a part of their recovery program. So we're our hats off to the Kenosha YMCA for making this program possible. And it's been very, very effective. So that's kind of the education piece that we're trying to push.
Right. And, of course, in addition to all that you do for just kind of general support, which will include this vigil that we'll talk about in a moment, you're engaged in the really important work of advocacy to try to move the needle when it comes to laws that can make such a big difference in terms of the lives of the mentally ill and what is open to them, the way insurance functions and so on. What would you say are the highest priorities in the advocacy wing of NAMI right now?
Well, I think you have some federal legislation that's coming through. You also have some state legislation. And I think an excellent example of something that's happened recently within our state, and that is the state legislation that was passed that allowed children to be participants in our Comprehensive Community Services Program. I mean, this has been fantastic because I think we're trying more and more to reach out to our children. And I have a program here that I'd also like to talk about with respect to education, and it ties in advocacy and support, and that is ending the silence. And I'll talk about that in a minute. But back to this, the advocacy piece. Right now, this inclusion of children in the Comprehensive Community Service Program has just been a real godsend to getting the services to children, and it's so, so positive. And I think another outreach that we are doing in the education piece is the Ending the Silence. Now, this is a program where we have three teams. Lisa Zanin, who is a retired special ed teacher, KUSD, leads this effort. We've had great cooperation with Sue Valeri at KUSD. And what we are doing is we are going out to health classes. We're going out to psychology classes, if they have them in the school, AP psychology. And we are reaching out, and we're trying to give the students a better toolkit to deal with mental health issues and crises, just like we do with the law enforcement and CIT, just like we do with the general public and CIP. And this has been very successful. This school year, we've reached over 1,200 students in KUSD.
And is that geared for if they have peers, classmates with these issues, or more at home, if they have parents or siblings that are dealing, or both?
I think it's for both, actually. And it gives them some, if they have a friend, a peer, that may be in crisis, that may be considering a suicide, you know, talk to the people, be straight up with the people, listen to them. Listen is so important, because we as a society, I don't think we listen very well.
Hmm.
And so it's good for the kids, and they're getting better. And one of a real plus from this, in some of our sessions, we've actually had students come up and say, boy, that sounds just what I'm going through right now. Hmm. So we make a huge effort to get those kids help.
I should think that one of the most significant changes you've seen since you first experienced the difficulties of your two children is the relative openness that exists now that did not back then. Not that we talk about this enough or as openly as we should, but certainly that's one way in which it seems like we have moved in a positive direction, that this is not quite so dark a secret locked away in a closet like it once was.
That you're spot on. And I think that the younger generations are definitely more open about it. And they talk about it. I think I go back to my family. I had a sister that lived with depression since the mid-80s. Hmm. My mother never accepted the fact that she had a daughter with a mental illness.
Wow.
And that's the different generations. And I think that this is the kids we see in the schools today, the young adults, I mean, they're much more open about it. I think a caution that we also must be aware of, and that is with the onslaught of social media.
Hmm.
Social media can really be very bad on some children. And they that may push them over the edge. I mean, if you have a problem in a class, when we went to school, okay, maybe you had a problem, we had a difference of opinion, boom, you went home, done, fini. Now, if children are having trouble or they are being kind of ostracized or being picked on, that's continuous. That can be 24/7.
Right.
And that can really get to them. Mm. It really can get to them.
Right. Somebody who is kind of on the outside looking in can sometimes be victimized and bullied in a lot of painful ways that are ongoing, and because it doesn't happen within the walls of that schoolroom or the walls of that school, it can be even harder for instance people at school in a position of authority to be aware of it and try to do something about it. Yeah.
I think another, back to your question on advocacy, I think another thing that's been very important and that we continue to do, and that's serving as advocates as we go up with a county human services budget. Mm. I mean, that's extremely important. And I think the county has been very supportive. The county executives have been very supportive as the county board of supervisors. And we need to continue that. We've just had on April 27th, there was a presentation by John Jansen, Director of Human Services, about a recent study on Kenosha County mental health access. Okay, and it was done by Sunika Santala, who has previously worked with DHS, great resume, and also Dr. Greg Schmidt, who had been a psychiatrist formerly in charge of Mendota Mental Health Hospital. And so these folks looked at our community. They had the stakeholders. They went out and talked to different people, and this was presented. And it was it's out there right now. The study is complete, and now it comes a point when you pick what we can do. And I think part of the presentation that went down on the 27th is that it was a structure, timeline, and what's available dollar-wise. And so I think there are some long-term things, there are some short-term things. And so now it's going to be up to the county board to see how they can make some of these factors happen.
Mm. We're speaking with Jack Rose, who is co-president of the Kenosha County chapter of NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And they have a special event which is coming up tomorrow night. And we should mention that all of May is National Mental Illness Awareness Month. And in keeping with that, tomorrow night, Wednesday, May 18th, there is a special vigil on the concern and issue called Speak Up, Change Minds. And, of course, the whole idea of speaking up flows beautifully out of what you were talking about earlier about remaining silent no more. So, Jack, tell us what's going to be happening at this vigil tomorrow evening.
I'd be glad to. This has been a joint effort between Bridges Community Center and NAMI Kenosha County. And this is, in the recent past, it's been a partnership over the last 10 years. It has been going on for a lot longer than that, but this has been a very close partnership, and it's worked very well. The agenda will have a Kenosha County proclamation that right now Jim Cruiser, the county exec, is planning on making. And then we'll go through a series of awards, and these have been annual awards that we have been giving. And so one of the awards, our David Wagner Mental Health Advocacy Award, this year is going to go to Officer Luke Hoffman of the Kenosha Police Department. Now, Officer Luke is an Iraq War veteran, 11-year member of the Kenosha Police Department. He's a crisis intervention team officer, and he's just most worthy of this award. He's basically a mainstay in our role scenario portion of our CIT training, not only in Kenosha, but in Racine. He's also a member of the board of directors since 2014 of Bridges, and he's just truly engaged in mental health awareness in our community. His timely action in crisis situations as a CIT officer have been just most outstanding. And he also goes out and gives presentations on mental illness and mental illness awareness in our community. Now we have a Community Service Award, which this year the recipient is Dr. Herbert Rourke, MD. And Dr. Rourke has been a psychiatrist in our community for many years. He works tirelessly for his patients day and night to ensure good mental health care, and especially for those who lack sufficient resources. Mm. He backs his patient in criminal and justice cases, and he stands up for them, and he supports them. And he is the type of psychiatrist that he'll make calls to the Kenosha County Detention Center. And so he's truly a real man for all seasons who supplies mental health treatment to all the folks in our community. And so we thank Dr. Rourke for his community service. Hmm. And then the third award is the Exceptional Volunteer Award. And this year it goes to Chris Cohn, who is the webmaster for NAMI Kenosha County.
Oh.
And Chris has brought Kenosha County website into the 21st century. I mean, it's just been incredible. She's got a creative design. She does daily updates. At our board meetings, she'll bring a sheet and let us know how many hits we get, what's getting the attention. I mean, it's really incredible. And so she comes to us as an alumnus from our Family to Family program, and she's been elected to the board of directors in 2015, And she really steps up. She's a doer. She gets it done. She helps out with our annual fundraiser, our annual Christmas party. And so she is truly an exceptional volunteer. So those are the main awards. And we also have recognition for our Ending the Silence program that Lisa Zanin is going to handle. We'll have a reading from Sarah Lierke, and our featured speaker will be Carol Slavicek. And Carol has she's a member of our board. She's really been a mainstay in our mental health awareness program here in Kenosha County. So that's it in a nutshell, and it's open to the public, and we hope you come out. I mean, we've had all kinds of weather, as we've experienced, but at least tomorrow it looks like it's not going to rain.
Right. No, so. It's actually the forecast tomorrow is for it to be quite beautiful, actually. Sunny and a high of 63 degrees. Looks like it's going to be absolutely perfect for this event. Tell people exactly where this event is going to occur.
Yes. The Bridges Community Center is over on 7th Avenue. I think it's 5704 7th Avenue. Storefront's got a big NAMI banner in the window, and that'll be the reception at 5 p.m. And then we'll basically walk two blocks west over to Civic Center Park, and that is a park that's right in between Reuther, the courthouse, the Dinosaur Museum, and the post office. And so that will be the location. And so, again, we cordially invite the public to come out and share with us our mental health awareness vigil, because it's extremely important. The citizens of our community have been very supportive at our fundraisers. They have been very generous, and I sincerely believe that we have an outstanding network. We can always make it better in our community, but I truly believe that if somebody needs help and has a mental health issue in our community, we can get them that help.
If people want to visit NAMI's website, do you know what the address is?
Certainly do. NAMIKenosha.org. Please check it out. Check
NAMI,
it out.
N-A-M-I. NAMI.
N-A-M-I.
So NAMIKenosha.org. Great. Jack Rose, it's always great to talk with you, and I am always so impressed, of course, first of all, with your own passion and the breadth of experience and knowledge that you bring to this. And it's always great to hear about all of the different things that NAMI is doing to try to address this reality in all kinds of different ways. And that's just gratifying to see and hear about.
If I may, another thing that really helps and really is indicative of what we brought to the community, and that's our Oxford House program.
Oh, yeah.
Oxford House is a recovery program for addicts, many of which have a mental illness. And right now, Jane Davis has been extremely effective as the coordinator of Oxford House. The members operate the house. They do UA drops. They attend support groups as all part of their recovery. There's a structured residential setting. They have a president of Oxford House. They have like a vice president. They have somebody in charge of the facility of the house. They have somebody by the chow. And it's very, very well organized. And currently, there are three Oxford Houses in Kenosha. There's Oxford House Ayers, which is 2014 45th Street. That's been in existence since November 29th, 2010. Now, this is for men, and it's a 7-bed facility. We also have Oxford House Lena at 1630 56th Street. That's been open since July 1st, 2012. This is a 9-bed facility for women. It's the old safe house right across the street from Frank's school. And then recently, Oxford House Jerry C. Has been open on 2414 61st Street. February 1st of this year. And this is a 5-bed facility for men that may go to 7. And this has been extremely effective. And NAMI Kenosha has helped. We have provided some initial funding to help these Oxford houses get started. And right now we have a program that we attempt to support people that are just starting at Oxford House. And it's basically it's $200 to start, and then it costs them $100 a week just to keep going, okay? Mm-hmm. And so that has been effective. Jane Davis is doing a great job. And this has been very helpful with our drug and alcohol court that we have in our community and also our behavioral health treatment court that we have in our community. And we also have a veterans court that we're part of that sits at District 2 in Racine. But to the behavioral health treatment court and to the drug and alcohol, this has been extremely effective. And this is something that you provide treatment and not just incarceration. Mm-hmm. And Judge Milosaskis sits the bench for the drug and alcohol court. Judge Kirkman sits the bench for the behavioral health treatment court.
Mm-hmm. And when people find themselves in those situations, it's so good when somebody can be sitting on the bench who understands where they're coming from and some mm-hmm. of the special issues that are contributing factors and can, in a sense, render justice in a little more maybe comprehensive and humane right. fashion and can make such a difference.
And it's also for it's treatment. It's not incarceration.
Right.
It's cost effective. If you look at, I believe right now it's about $70 or $76 a day for a person that's incarcerated in a detention center. If you look at somebody that's in a specialty court such as drug and alcohol or behavioral health treatment court, you're talking about $12 to $15 a day. So do the math. I mean, it's extremely important. And so this is another plus for our community.
Right. And, of course, I'm sure you're hoping that people not only take note of this, but also will offer support.
Yes, yes. The whole effort of trying, many of the people that are in the specialty courts are able to work, but they may not be working right now. So any type of financial boost can really help them. And so NAMI Kenosha, we feel it's very important in any of our listening audience. If you have the same kind of feeling, please contact me, 605-9038, and we can certainly use your support.
Right.
Thank you.
And remind us once again of the address for your website.
Website, namikenosha.org. Please check it out.
And you're right. It's beautifully put together and well worth a visit. Jack Rose, co-president of the Kenosha chapter of NAMI, great to have you here on The Morning Show. Thank you so much. We hope a lot of people will turn out for the special mental health awareness vigil, which is tomorrow evening at Civic Center Park. So,
thank you very much, Greg. Really appreciate it.
Good to have you here. The time is 8:43. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. We are exploring the world of the human brain today and all that we think of in conjunction with study of the brain. And I have in hand a book called The Brain, An Illustrated History of Neuroscience. This is part of a very interesting series of books from Shelter Harbor Press called Ponderables, 100 Discoveries That Changed History, Who Did What When. And in this particular book, an especially fascinating entry in the series, we explore the way in which human beings have sought to understand themselves and what makes them human, and how humans very, very slowly came to a realization that the brain was an integral part of our own humanness. But of course, it took centuries for man to develop any kind of actual grasp of how the brain functions and exactly what it does. And of course, there are still mysteries that involve the brain that even in our modern age, we still do not completely understand. So when it comes to various scientific disciplines, there may be isn't a discipline quite as fascinating as that of neuroscience. And the man who is seeking to unlock this rich and varied and intriguing history for us is none other than Tom Jackson, who is a highly regarded science writer who lives in the United Kingdom. And he specializes in taking scientific matters, and in particular the historic view of various scientific disciplines, and bringing it into the realm of the general public, where we can at least try to understand some of what has gone on. And I'm very, very happy that I can have this opportunity to speak with him about his book, which again is called The Brain, An Illustrated History of Neuroscience, published by Shelter Harbor Press. And Tom Jackson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I sure appreciate it. Where are you talking to me from this morning?
I'm based in Bristol in the west of England.
Very good. Well, it's great to be talking with you, and congratulations on a really superb book. As you undertook this assignment, at the outset, did you have a full understanding and appreciation of just how complex an assignment this was, of just how complex the history of neuroscience was?
No, it's the short answer. The longer one is that I didn't know how early it started, really, how early the history of our attempts to understand the brain go back. But it would appear that there were neurosurgeons or brain surgeons working 10,000 years ago, chiseling holes in people's skulls. There are many skulls that have been found with these holes in. They appear to, the owner of those skulls appear to survive the procedure. So we know that it wasn't a blow to the head that killed them. It was actually a deliberate hole being cut into their heads. So that's really the beginning of the story. What I wasn't really prepared for was how, as you said in your intro, how new the science was and how many more questions there still are to answer. I'm used to dealing with other specific narratives, things like chemistry and physics and biology and geology, these venerable old subjects that have been around for centuries and have had many, many famous names, discovering many famous whereas neuroscience is still very young. The surprising thing was how relatively recently, people were still kind of working on hunches. They were still just had a, they were working towards, and there wasn't the solid grounding from earlier discoveries that they were that they could build from. And it's not until probably the 1960s that you get in, that neuroscience gets into that realm. Hmm. Where, along with the more established sciences, they're building a firm, solid foundations, discovery upon discovery.
Right. One of the things that's really intriguing as we read the earlier part of your book is how often there is somebody who will make an essentially correct assumption about the brain, and yet right alongside that core matter of whatever they have assumed to be true, which happens to be correct, they will make a plethora of other assumptions that, in fact, aren't correct at all. And this helps explain sort of the fits and starts of this growth of what we ultimately called neuroscience.
Well, that's right. Yeah, science is all in the same way. There's a thing called they enter what's known as a crisis, where all the established theories cease to, the number of questions that the established theories can't answer, just get to a crisis point. There are so many unanswered questions that they have to basically assume that the theories are incorrect, and they have to come up with a new one, and they have this, you know, what's known as the paradigm shift, where discovery just turns up, or a new set of ideas arrives, normally from one source that just rewrites the whole thing. Those paradigm shifts are very famous in other sciences. In neuroscience, they were still probably waiting for they're waiting for the next paradigm shift. There's it's trying to find a physical link between what's going on in the brain with the mental processes that make us human, and that really has so far proven to be quite a difficult task.
Right. It brings to mind one of the central points you make in the introduction to the book, which I think is worth our talking about, in which you talk about the staggering complexity of the human brain, and yet, on the other hand, its utter simplicity, that it is this incredibly complex system, and yet, as sort of a physical organ, astonishingly simple. And you tell us that sort of the relationship between those two, the physical simplicity of the brain versus its rich complexity in terms of how it functions, the trying to sort that matter out, in a sense, is the heart and soul of neuroscience. Explain to our listeners what you are spelling out here in terms of the complexity versus the simplicity of the human brain.
Sure. Well, if you picked up a human brain, it would it weighs pounds. It'd be comprised mostly of fat, basically. It's a 3-pound lump of fat. There aren't any bones in it. There's nothing. There's some calcification here and there, but it's not a particularly solid organ at all. So that's the gross anatomy, the grossest of anatomy. But within that, there are 83 billion neurons, tiny nerve cells, these sort of branched cells that have a cell body, which people might understand. But unlike other cells in the body, there are dozens of little branches, and they all connect to their neighbors. So when you've got 83 billion of them, and they can all make dozens of connections to their neighbors, some suggest that one neuron can make 1,000 connections with its neighbors. So when you do the maths on that, you get to a staggeringly large number of connections within the brain, in the trillions.
Right.
So that makes the brain the most complicated, the most complex system that has ever been discovered.
Can you say a word to our listeners about something that you mentioned right after the introduction, which is called the Human Connectome Project? I had not heard of this, but it sounds like an amazing undertaking. Explain to our listeners what this is about.
It's the wiring diagram. It's an attempt to... the brain is organized in layers. And so when you're looking at the outside, you're seeing the neocortex, which is a relatively thin layer of cells that's covering the brain. They're folded in on themselves to increase the surface. And if you could unfold that surface layer, it would cover a couple of tennis courts. That sort of area. But and all those all those cells within that surface are all sort of wired in the lower regions of the rest of the brain that's hidden underneath. And so the Human Connectome Project is similar to the Human Genome Project. It's trying to create a gram for the human brain, so how all of these different sections of the brain wire together. It's the electrical wiring that we're talking about here. So the branch cells, the neurons that we were talking about, they communicate through pulses of electricity. So along branches that are connecting to their neighbors, you've got pulses of electricity which then make a chemical leap from one cell to the next. It's been understood for about 100 years or so, 100 years or so, that process. They aren't like switches. They don't just turn on and off. It's not just firing one message, like zapping the next door neighbor. It's sending pulses, and the pulses of the pattern of those pulses varies. A cell within a branch of each cell. So the code that the brain is using is incredibly complicated, far beyond the sort of thing that a computer would do. But they also believe that there may be glial. As well as neurons, there are other cells, glial cells, within the brain, and they used to be thought to be sort of support cells for the electrical neuron network. It's possible. There's a growing school of thought that maybe there is a chemical connection, a chemical network that's running through the glial cells as well. So if you've got 83 billion neurons, add in a similar number of glial cells, and you've just, you know, you've doubled. I can't even do the maths. I just, perhaps you've doubled your connections. Perhaps you've your number's gone from the trillions into the quadrillions. So the human connectome is trying to create the electrical map. Whether that's enough to understand, as I said before, to create the link between the mental and the physical, whether that is the breakthrough we need, we won't know until it's finished. It's been going for 5-6 years, who knows how long it's going to take.
Right. We're speaking with Tom Jackson about his book, The Brain, an illustrated history of neuroscience, part of a series called Ponderables, 100 Discoveries That Changed History, Who Did What When. His fascinating book, richly illustrated, by the way, is a history of neuroscience, of how human beings have struggled to understand the importance of the brain and its function. Mr. Jackson, one of the things that was especially intriguing to me as an American reading your book is how the history of neuroscience is not a straight line that sweeps out of the heart of Europe, for instance, but that there are other places on Earth where important breakthroughs were made, sometimes ancient breakthroughs were made, in places like Egypt and China and Iraq and other places around the globe that we might not immediately think of as places where what we think of now as scientific discoveries might be made. Were you surprised at just how, in a sense, how far-reaching this history would be?
I kind of knew that the Egyptians much of the brain... already, it's perhaps common knowledge that when your pharaohs and your Egyptian nobility were mummified for the afterlife, the brain was, while a lot of the organs were very carefully handled in order to remain intact for the next journey, the brain literally just scraped out through a hole made in the top of the nose and just thrown away. The Egyptians thought that the brain did nothing more than shed excess heat from the body. It was like a radiator, so the blood coming up from the body was sent through the many. The Egyptians could see that there was a huge blood supply. Coming into the brain, they probably also saw that other animals had an even more intricate blood supply. Things like oxen and goats and things like that would have an even more intricate blood supply into their brains. And they assumed that was some kind of heat dispersal system. To them, everything was taking place in the heart, and we still, even today, you know, when we talk from the heart, or my heart tells me this, or I have a broken heart, that sort of language comes from ancient Egypt.
Tom Jackson, and that's just a tiny bit of a fascinating interview which we conducted about his really interesting book called The Brain.